got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
In the news, President-elect Joe Biden says one of the first things he'll do after taking office in January is ask all Americans to wear facial coverings for 100 days to curb the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States.
He has also, by the way, asked Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, to be his chief medical advisor and part of his COVID-19 response team, and Dr. Fauci accepted.
So on January 20th, Biden will issue a standing order that masks be worn in places where he has authority to issue such an order. Now, these include all federal buildings and in interstate transportation, such as airplanes and buses. In the meantime, a study came out of Denmark that you may have heard of on the news that tested whether paper surgical face masks protect the people who wear them. Interestingly, this study comes just a week after the CDC updated its guidance on masks.
The new study seemed to say that although masks are not just for the benefit of others, they also help keep people who wear them from getting sick to some degree.
What the vast number of studies show, including the Danish study, is that masks bring down the community viral load. So most likely there is less getting out, and that means there's less for you to be exposed to. In the Danish study, 6,000 citizens were divided into two groups. The first group was asked to wear a paper surgical mask, which was considered to be 98% effective at screening small particles any time they went out in public for a month.
Remember that with this type of mask, there are still gaps where unfiltered air can reach the nose and mouth. The mask group watched a video explaining how to wear masks properly and got 50 free masks in the mail.
The second group was called the control group. The study was considered valid since the number of people in the study was considerable, at least by study standards.
In other words, the trial was designed to look for a big benefit for people who wear masks. It didn't find that large benefit.
After 1 month, 42 people out of the 2,392 in the group that wore masks, about 1.8%, developed a COVID-19 infection, compared to 53 people out of 2,470 in the group that didn't wear masks, or about 2.1%. Now, that is really a pretty small benefit of wearing a mask, about 16% reduction in infections on average in people who said they wore their masks as they were told.
That result didn't pass a test for statistical significance, so meaning that it could have been due to chance.
Now, we'll let you make a decision on how important these results are. The study is still consistent with results of other similar studies. But there are plenty of reasons not to abandon masks based on just this one study.
Maybe the study is flawed, since there was no way, at least in this study, to make sure that the people did wear their mask appropriately. It didn't actually monitor the volunteers to make sure that they actually did.
But think of it this way. Maybe this study was more in touch with reality, because that's what we do in the U.S. as well. We advise people to wear masks. Yet if you walk around any city in the U.S., some people are wearing masks over their noses, and others are wearing them hanging off one ear. This really makes the study more of a practical, real-world test.
Remember that the surgical mask was invented not to protect the surgeon, but to protect the patients from the surgeon. You were preventing the surgeon coughing or breathing into open surgical wounds and causing infection in the patient.
The CDC is not changing its recommendation based on the Dana study. In fact, they stated that their recommendation remains the same because they are emphasizing the utility of masking for community control of this pandemic.
But one thing the study should do in reality is knock down any false sense of confidence that people may get when they have a mask on.
Many people today feel that they can go to a crowded setting wearing a mask and they're going to be just fine. The truth is, you're probably not fine since you're still not invulnerable to infection. On another note today, the House of Representatives passed legislation legalizing marijuana at the federal level Friday. Now, this is the first time that any chamber of Congress has voted on this matter.
This particular bill, called the MORE Act, passed by a mostly party line 228 to 164 vote. Unfortunately, the Republican-controlled Senate is unlikely to take up the legislation.
The measure, if it could actually pass the Senate as well, would remove marijuana from the federal list of controlled substances and expunge some marijuana-related criminal records. Of course, it would still be up to states to pass their own regulations on the sale of marijuana.
By the way, Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, was one of only a handful of Republicans to vote for the legislation and was actually the only Republican co-sponsor of the legislation.
More marijuana news came out of the elections as four more states passed marijuana legalization measures in the November elections, bringing the total number of states with legal marijuana use for adults to 15. Remember that medical marijuana is legal in 36 states, and that includes Florida.
One thing that may come out of the Biden administration is that President-elect Biden has said that he supports the legalization of medical marijuana and would leave decisions on recreational use up to the states.
We would also like to talk about something called concierge medicine. It's becoming more common in our country over the past few years, and you may not have even heard of it. Specifically, concierge medicine is a healthcare model in which a patient pays a fee. Now, this could be monthly, biannually, or even yearly, not to an insurance company, but directly to your doctor for the practice's services.
One of the advantages of this model is that patients would have access to their doctor or another physician in the practice whenever they want.
Patients would be able to make same-day appointments with little or no waiting, and that's something that we haven't seen in a long time. Now, it seems that to get same-day service, you need to go to the ER. This overburdens the ER with non-emergent cases, and this is especially bad during the period of COVID infections.
I think that the best way to explain this is using the attorney arrangement where the lawyer is kept on a retainer by the client. In other words, the client can obtain legal services whenever they need them and don't pay by the hour or case.
As for costs, the annual fee to subscribe to most concierge medicine practices ranges from $1,200 to $3,000, at least according to the website conciergemedicinetoday.org. Now, most concierge medical practices don't take health insurance. At this time, about half accept only cash payments. Now, this does not mean just cash. It also includes credit, debit cards, as well as checks.
Now, a little less than one-third concierge medicine practices take Medicare or some insurance, and only about 6% take private insurance, but no Medicare.
So if you have Medicare or other health insurance, you can join a concierge medical practice, but you'll have to pay the membership fee yourself.
If you do have Medicare and wish to go to a concierge medicine practice, it is important that you know that the practice cannot include additional charges for items or services that Medicare usually covers unless Medicare won't pay for the item or service.
In those situations, your physician must give you a written notice, which is known as an advance beneficiary notice of non-coverage, listing the services and reasons why Medicare may not pay. The same rules are similar for those with private health insurance, as you must pay the fee yourself to become a patient in a concierge practice. And there are, of course, more stipulations concerning prescription drugs and additional diagnostic tests not covered by the concierge medicine fees.
Therefore, concierge medicine may not be the best fit for someone with an HMO, for example.
Now, Carmen and I do not expect this to be a complete explanation of concierge medicine, but we did want to enlighten you on just another way that healthcare can be provided now and in the future. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. If you've heard our radio show previously or listened to our mid-show talks about Southside Medical Center, you may have heard that our office is able to help those with narcotic substance abuse issues.
One of the medications that is often used in that regard is the drug buprenorphine. It is often combined with another medication called naloxone.
Two brand name drugs, Suboxone and Subutex, were approved by the FDA in the year 2002. My gosh, that's 18 years ago, right, Carmen?
Yes, it is.
Prior to 2000, the Drug Addiction Treatment Act was passed. The primary medication to treat opiate addiction was methadone.
The prime benefit of these new drugs was that they could be prescribed by physicians who have been trained and certified by the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment to treat opiate addiction.
While methadone is still a Schedule II substance, buprenorphine is a Schedule III substance, denoting it as a drug with a lower potential for abuse. So buprenorphine is often considered to be a safer opiate treatment medication than methadone.
According to the Drug Enforcement Agency, almost 16,000 physicians were certified to prescribe buprenorphine-based products like Suboxone and Subutex in 2013 alone.
And in 2012, 9.3 million prescriptions were written for these medications. Now, I love math, so I could not help myself, and I took those numbers, dividing the number of prescriptions written in a year by the number of physicians prescribing them. It ended up that each certified prescriber wrote in an average 581 prescriptions in a year. That means that the daily average for each prescribing physician was just a little over two prescriptions a day. In other words, two patients daily were being treated with a buprenorphine medication for drug addiction daily.
According to the National Center for Drug Abuse Statistics, in 2018, 53 million or 19.4% of people aged 12 years and older used illegal drugs.
Remember that figure that I gave you a moment ago of 9.3 million prescriptions? Now, that does not mean 9.3 million people received buprenorphine, since each prescription is generally for a period of no more than 1 month. This means that only, on average, 775,000 addicts were on a buprenorphine treatment plan that year. And that means less than 10% of the addicts were treated using buprenorphine. 10%. Remember that number, and we'll probably get back to that later.
First, we need to tell you a little about buprenorphine. Prior to it being used as a medication in a treatment plan for drug abuse, buprenorphine was used as a pain reliever.
Is it an opioid? Well, yes, it is. But then so is methadone, which has been used for years in drug abuse treatment centers. Now, we could talk for hours on how that came to be, but we only have a half-hour show, so today we'll just continue talking only about buprenorphine. It's what's called a partial opioid agonist. You know, when I first heard that term in med school, the things that I thought about were the links between the word agonist and agony. But in reality, the simplest description of an opioid agonist is that it is a chemical that acts in ways similar to an opiate, but whose purpose is to trick the brain.
It does this by giving the user the same feeling that he or she would receive if they were taking an opiate, such as the endorphin rush, complete with pain, numbing, and euphoria.
So an opiate agonist is kind of like a placeholder occupying the receptors in the brain where an opiate would be attached if there was actually an opiate in the person's body at the time. So buprenorphine binds with opioid receptors in the brain, causing reduced pain and feelings of well-being. While buprenorphine isn't a full opioid, it acts much like one, causing moderate receptor site activity, except it does not create a euphoric state when taken as directed. As a result, buprenorphine will prevent withdrawal symptoms from and reduce cravings for opiate drugs like heroin.
There are several advantages to using a medication like buprenorphine in the treatment of opiate abuse. First of all, buprenorphine can help the individual to remain safe and comfortable during the so-called detox period.
It can also reduce or eliminate cravings for heroin or other opiates, as well as minimize relapses, since the individual is not experiencing uncomfortable withdrawal symptoms. Apart from these effects, buprenorphine allows the individual to focus on therapy without being distracted by withdrawal symptoms and cravings. At the beginning of this discussion, I said that there were, in effect, two types of medications that contain buprenorphine. Initially, when the medication first came out, they were Suboxone and Subutex. So what's the difference between those, Suboxone and Subutex? Both Subutex and Suboxone do contain buprenorphine. We've already said that. In Subutex, that's the only thing that is contained, just buprenorphine, and it was formulated first. And while it was found to be relatively effective in the treatment of opiate addiction, there was still a tendency to abuse the drug.
Many users sought to inject the drug intravenously in order to obtain the high they had become accustomed to with the heroin and other illicit drugs.
So they developed another drug to address this issue, and it was called Suboxone. Suboxone contains buprenorphine and naloxone. Remember that we said that buprenorphine was an opiate agonist? Well, naloxone is an opioid antagonist, which means that it blocks the effects of opioids at the receptor sites. So naloxone was combined with buprenorphine to deter abuse of the medication.
If someone injects Suboxone, the person will immediately go into precipitated withdrawal, which can be distressing.
The FDA, DEA, and the American Society of Addiction Medicine, as well as the Suboxone manufacturer and addictionologists, do prefer Suboxone over Subutex because of the reduced risk of abuse. And remember, initially Subutex was priced higher than Suboxone.
However, in the past few years, these brand name medications were being produced generically. This means that other manufacturers could sell the same products under their own names.
Now it seems that the cost of the buprenorphine naloxone combination drugs is more costly to the patient than the drug that contains buprenorphine alone. Now, this has led many patients to request the non-combination drug. In a quick summary, Cara and I looked it up. 2 milligrams buprenorphine sublingual tablet costs $38 for 30 tablets, while the 8 milligram buprenorphine tablet costs $62 for 30.
Compare this to the combination medication where the 2 milligram tablet costs $58 for 30 and the 8 milligram tablet costs around $80 for 30.
Now, many, if not most, of those receiving buprenorphine get around 60 tablets a month, taking 2 a day. Therefore, the buprenorphine tablets will cost around $120 monthly, while the combination medicine will set them back about $160. This savings of $40 a month is enough to have many of those who are prescribed the medication requesting the single medication form rather than the combination form, as they would save an average of $480 a year.
Now, some people are allergic or just have side effects from the naloxone in the combination drug. So, these people rightfully get prescribed the single medication tablet or films.
Also, since Subutex is used during pregnancy, there is more experience using buprenorphine than naloxone during the pregnancy. So, buprenorphine appears to be fairly safe for the fetus, and most physicians, therefore, will not prescribe the combination drug in pregnant women.
Now, it seems that many pharmacists are requiring the physicians to prove that the patients have had actual adverse reactions previously to the combination drug before allowing the physician to prescribe the single medication form, that is, buprenorphine alone.
What I'd like to know is how many patients across the country who now are being prescribed a single-dose medication will be unwilling to continue on the other more expensive choice. Will this be a risk to many of going back to the more dangerous addiction rather than pay the additional price? Just a thought.
And finally, on a lighter note, we would like to present two conditions. First is something called walking corpse syndrome.
You've probably seen some TV shows such as The Walking Dead and a myriad of movies involving, let's just say, zombies, where people walk around who are actually dead. Movies, of course, right?
Well, those people with walking corpse syndrome, better known in medical circles as Cotard's syndrome, have an actual neuropsychiatric disorder in which the person believes they are dead or missing their soul, organs, blood, or certain body parts.
This is actually a component of psychiatric illness such as depression, but neuroimaging has also linked some cases of Cotard's to actual neurological changes. Luckily, many patients can spontaneously experience a complete recovery, even in severe cases. Unluckily, some don't. Then, there is foreign accent syndrome.
Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome. Foreign accent syndrome.
Here, the people actually seem to develop a foreign accent.
The disorder is caused by damage to a part of the brain associated with speech.
The most common cause is stroke, but other causes include trauma, tumors, and even multiple sclerosis.
Sometimes speech therapy helps, but symptoms can last years and actually become permanent.
And so we must say goodbye. You know, Carmen, I don't even know what that accent was.
Here comes the doctor. He comes to see me. Here comes the doctor. He comes to heal me. I am here to tell him all about my story. I am here to tell him all about my pain. A long time ago, they used to call me an addict.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.